Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do the arts enhance learning? Exposing children to a rich creative culture for which North Texas is gaining a national reputation can plant a seed for a lifelong engagement with the arts. But research shows it can also help them with their academic work, from history and writing to math and the physical sciences. And those learning opportunities are just as plentiful after school as they are in the art and music classes students take during the day. In Dallas, a program called Thriving Minds brings working artists into classrooms and offers students opportunities for artistic experiences after the school day ends. Gigi Antoni is president and CEO of the creative learning organization Big Thought, which developed the Thriving Minds program. Daniel Windham is director of arts for the Wallace Foundation, which today announced it will invest an additional $4 million in Big Thought's efforts on behalf of area students. Welcome, both of you, to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
In order to talk about creative learning in childhood, I think it makes sense to fast forward and talk about the value of creativity in the workplace today. More and more American jobs require people to think creatively.
Think creatively, think beyond what has been expected of us in the past, to imagine solutions that have not been a part of our normal, everyday work consideration. So it's important to think about how children will come to approach the world and to look at the demands that are being placed upon adults today. We can only imagine what those demands will be tomorrow, and know that we want to make sure that children have every opportunity to reach adulthood successfully. And we also know through the research that the arts will, in fact, be a necessary part of them achieving adulthood successfully.
So this goes far beyond, Gigi, just taking kids once in their elementary school years to the opera or to a play. Can you talk a little bit about the scope of the program?
Sure. So what we know is that in order to get the kinds of effects that Daniel's talking about, these sorts of assets that we want kids to have to be successful as adults, and we have to have multiple experiences over a child's development. So this isn't just about going to the opera once a year. It's not just even about what happens in a year. It's about what kids get throughout their development in our city. So Thriving Minds works to make sure that there are arts in school every week for kids. We make sure that there are multiple experiences annually in the community, in the classroom, in schools, and that children in out-of-school time have the opportunity to pursue creative learning, learn to play the piano, learn to use a camera, learn to plan and execute a garden, learn to do all those things and out-of-school time that are a very, very important part of children getting the skills they need to be successful.
The out-of-school component is really interesting because it's very easy, especially living in the state of Texas, I think, for kids to assume that the only extracurricular activity out there is sports.
Oh, well, we know from the sports people that they don't believe that.
Really?
So we should take a page from their very successful playbook and recognize that the constellation of opportunities that any community would want to provide for children includes all of the assets that the community has. So what we're looking to do is not ask for any place of prominence, but we're asking for partnerships across the network of opportunities for children to partner with sports leaders, to partner with science leaders, to partner with people who are interested in books and literature and reading and creating, quilt makers, whomever, so that we can pass the child to the person, to that caring adult who has the child's interest at heart. And that might be an artist, that might be a coach, that might be a quilt maker, that might be a librarian, that might be a scientist. But if the community has the child at the center of its focus, then the community is able to respond in appropriate manners to the child's needs at the right time.
What do we know about the differences between kids who are socioeconomically equal but either have a great exposure to the arts or do not?
I'm not sure I understand the question. So when you say socioeconomically equal.
So if they're sort of the same family background, same sort of income level, right. One's in a school where there's art and music and has some after school activities, and the other one doesn't have those things.
Yeah, it's really interesting, the gap. We call it an opportunity gap. So we talk a lot about an achievement gap. And Certainly, that's maybe the result of the fact that we don't have equitable opportunities. So James Catterall's just published one at UCLA as a researcher that takes a look at this very question. And he's just published a new book called Doing Well and Doing Good Through the Arts. And in his research, he's tracked kids over decades and decades to look at that very question. And what we find is that even if kids are in schools with high arts, even if they don't engage deeply in that, even they get a boost in terms of success going forward beyond, high school. More of those kids graduate. More of those kids attain a higher level of education afterwards. There's really a growing body of research. It's pretty undeniable that arts learning is like rocket fuel for academic achievement. There's a deep correlation between how engaged kids are and how lively their opportunities are in their learning environment and how well and they do in school.
What fascinates me about this approach is that it seems as if the old way was that there were, the five or six academic subjects, and then you went off and you did music or you did art and you made some visual art project. And it sounds like a lot of what you're working to do actually allows teachers to integrate art into history or math and allows artists to come in and sort of help teach and help students learn. Is that a new way of thinking, or is that, in fact, something very old that we had lost sight of for a while?
Well, if you go back beyond the good old days of the 50s, and when I listen to my parents talk about their education was very broadly defined. In-school and out-of-school learning was linked. The social studies teacher might have also been the chess coach, who may have also been the husband or wife of the music teacher. So because they lived in small communities, and because they brought assets of a family through a small community to each and every member of that community, there was a seamlessness to the way children learned. They passed kids off from house to house, from school to church to community center, and it wasn't as compartmentalized as it is now. We now live in huge spaces with huge numbers of people. We have had to respond differently to the way we work with children in education. And that has led to a kind of compartmentalization that we're now trying to figure out how to do it better. We can't change the numbers, but we can change the methodology. We can change the way we disseminate information. We can change the way we bring children in and out of experiences. And so what we're looking to do now is to give the social studies teacher what he or she already knows, that it's not the date that is meaningful, but it's the context and the date of that, whatever it is, the treaty or whatever it is, the war. What did people sing before the war broke out? What did they look at and call beautiful after the treaty? We have come to find facts because of the growing need for placing facts in stream in computers to sometimes lose the context that these facts reside in. And what we're asking teachers to do in working with artists and working with each other to broadly color and to richly texture the work that children are doing so that they can find the meaning in whatever it is that they're studying and make sense of it for how they're going to go through their day and their lives going forward.
And so that in the end, what we're trying to create and what we are creating are contexts in which kids can apply what they're learning in the classroom and for it to be highly engaged, highly hands-on, and very meaningful and to make meaning. The siloing of learning between 8 and 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the idea that we're going to highly educate children between 8 and 3 and, certain months out of the year is really it's not getting us there. It's not working. And the narrowing and focusing on skills without context and the ability to apply those skills isn't working very well for us either. And so this question that you're asking about how the arts can help kids understand other things that they're learning in other subjects, really we don't learn in silos. We don't just learn to read in language arts class. We learn to read all day, everywhere. And so the arts belong in all those places as well because they help kids make meaning and understand context.
Do you still both feel like you're fighting the perception that there's some competition between academic subjects, and I use air quotes around that, mm-hmm. and the arts, or has that started to dissolve?
Well, I think that there it's not necessarily competitive, but it's certainly separate. Mm-hmm. The strong urgency around having children achieve on standardized tests has perforce led schools to direct much of their time and resources to the test and to having children do better on those tests. If you're teaching to that and if you're directing your resources to the test, then you're going to have to make certain kinds of choices. And for reasons that are perhaps understandable but regrettable nonetheless, school has become a place where, in many instances, we have asked children to become test takers. What we are interested in coming to Dallas and in the other cities that we're working, which include Boston and Los Angeles, Minneapolis, is here are communities that have come together and said, we understand the need to perform well on tests. We also understand that that may not be the goal of education. It may be one of the litmus tests. It may be one of the ways we measure our competitiveness in the world and some of the things we understand about economic growth and stability. But we also understand that children are broader in need than that, and our responsibility is broader in response to that need.
Gigi, did the arts community in Dallas and the rest of North Texas always understand what you were trying to do when you started out?
Well, you know, the truth is that this is not a new way for the arts community in Dallas to work or for the school district in the city to work together with the arts community. Mm-hmm. The truth is that Dallas has been engaged in this kind of work over the last 13 years. And the Wallace Foundation, seeing that work, I think was part of why they were attracted to the work we were doing here. So, you know, I would say that this city is remarkable and its cultural community is remarkable because of the level of understanding about their place in helping to lift children up. And I think we are a city that is remarkably collaborative and generous, and we find ways to leverage what we have as a cultural community on behalf of children. And we do it hand in hand with our school district, which is pretty remarkable. I mean, our Dallas Independent School District has put music and visual art back into every classroom in the city. It's the first time since 1978 that the arts have been in DISD at a systemic level. It's a remarkable thing in this day and age for an urban school district to do that as part of their understanding that it isn't that we're going to raise test scores by educating the whole child and by meeting all of their needs, not just by doing what Daniel has described that have been choices that have been made in other places in the country. And that's a remarkable thing about this city and about its district.
And if I might add, one of the things that's interesting to us about the ISD and its leadership by Michael Hinojosa is that we understand as a foundation that things will happen and that you'll have to make choices. Even if we have the greatest understanding today, something that the only thing constant is change. Mm-hmm. What is intriguing to us is that Dallas has engaged in dealing with the changes that it has to, but it has decided that its commitment to the arts is strong enough that it will not change that particular brick in the wall. And so for us, the question is, why? What is it that you believe in so strongly that when you know you must change the matrix of opportunities, why have you made the decisions differently than many of your peer districts across the country have? What is it that you see? What is it that you believe? We don't know what the answer is, but we know that other people want to know.
We are talking this hour with Daniel Windham, who is Director of Arts for the Wallace Foundation, and Gigi Antoni, President and CEO of Big Thought. We're speaking this hour about the value of arts education and how it's being done. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about the value of arts education with Gigi Antoni, who is president and CEO of Big Thought, and Daniel Windham, director of arts for the Wallace Foundation. You can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Daniel, following up on what you were discussing earlier, the fact that you're not quite sure what keeps Dallas very committed to the arts, I am curious as to whether observing similar programs in different parts of the country, how the lessons that you learn are different and how certain things have to be adjusted to accommodate local tastes and preferences and realities.
Well, you have either the benefit or the joy of being the leader mm-hmm. in this. So Dallas is the oldest partner that we have in this enterprise. The other cities that I mentioned are coming behind Dallas. So what we're looking at is taking lessons and as opposed to most, sometimes people talk about best practices. Mm-hmm. And we say, don't do that. Here's a useful lesson. See now how when it's applied in your context, in your life, and with your people, whether it works. And if it doesn't work, what we're interested in is how will you change it? If the eye is on the prize of making sure that the child has the engagement that we're all committed to having. So the lessons so far are that partnership is tough going, and you must stay dedicated to it. You need a committed and passionate and charismatic leader, and in Gigi Antoni, you have it. You need comparable leadership at the school district, and Michael Hinojosa, you have it. You have a mayor who is now talking about arts learning as a major thrust in the educational life of the city for its children. These things are not normal to life in America. So that what we're asking people is, don't just do this. Talk to each other, mayors to mayor, school superintendent, cultural leader to cultural leader. Why are you making these choices, and how are you supporting each other so that it's a win-win game, so that everyone can have what they need, because your goals are going to be different to a degree. City context will change. But in fact, if we can stay focused on children, using the jobs and the authority that we have in those positions, we can probably make something happen where nothing would if we didn't work together. It's not about the money, and we can't do it alone. So let's pool the resources we have, and let's work together. That's what we're learning, and how people do that, we'll roll it up at the end of the day, which will be another 5 or 6 or 7 years from now, and tell the story of how Dallas did it, how Boston did it, how Los Angeles did it, so that cities across the country will have the benefit of the learning and the experience that has been taking place across this country in places like Dallas.
Gigi, with so much emphasis on ensuring that this doesn't end when the school bell rings at 3 o'clock or 3:15, what needs to happen for parents to encourage their kids' interest in the arts and to expose, in some cases, if they haven't had the benefit of this kind of education themselves, expose them for the first time?
It's a great question and an amazing challenge because, you know, parents are kids' first teachers. They're the most influential people in children's lives. And we have here in this city real barriers to families getting this kind of learning in their neighborhoods, because we tend to be siloed in the way we distribute these experiences and out of school time. And that's one of the early learnings that we've had in the work that we're doing. So we have to bring these experiences into neighborhoods where parents and kids are. We have to make them part of the drinking water at a neighborhood level, so that it's wonderful that we have these incredible cultural institutions and these great buildings and these wonderful cultural centers. And that's a very big part of the system and an integral part of it. But it's also important that you can leave school and go straight to a piano lesson, no matter where you live in the city, if that's what you're interested in learning. It's important that kids have rich, ongoing, meaningful learning experiences from 3 to 6, whether you live, no matter what part of the city you live in, no matter what school you're going to. And that's the vision for out-of-school time. I think we know that our real ultimate goals of helping kids get a good education and more of our kids being successful, matriculating through school and going on to get whatever education they need and want as they leave our school system, that out-of-school time is a key part of this. So it has to be coordinated services, and it has to be delivered in neighborhoods in a convenient way for parents and kids.
Well, and I guess what makes those extraordinary edifices we've built downtown less intimidating is exposure to what they're going to see long before they ever walk in.
No question, mm-hmm. and a context in which to experience them. Mm-hmm. So access is definitely part of how we measure success in Thriving Minds. More and more activities that are more and more accessible to more and more kids and families. But it's also about the experience itself and whether it's authentic and it's relevant and it's contextualized for the people that are experiencing it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Grace in Fort Worth. Hi, Grace.
Hi. I was a middle school science teacher for years here in the Fort Worth district. About 15 years ago, we applied for and got a Getty Art Institute grant for our school. One of the requirements of that grant was that we write units including several subjects. And one of the examples was very, very successful, and we did a unit. I was doing a unit on scientific naming, you know, like genus and species, and we were studying dinosaurs. So I asked required the kids to invent a dinosaur, and they had to name it, and they had to describe it, and they had to describe its habitat. But they were describing something that was imaginary. But they had to name it scientifically that had something to do with its description. The children that were in art, I worked with the art teacher, and they did their dinosaur in paper mache. The ones that were not in art had to draw it on a poster, including the habitat.
I'm guessing, Grace, that they were really enthusiastic about
the
assignment.
They loved it, especially the ones that were in art.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your call.
Well, let me tell you the end of this. The art students, their sculptures went to district art show, and our middle school won the district art show for sculpture.
Wow.
So,
congratulations.
Anyway, it can really work and animate the kids because they get it from all directions.
Thank you so much for your call. What a great example of this sort of thing at work.
The landmark work of the Getty Foundation, now known as DBAE, Discipline-Based Arts Education, is very foundational to the work that's going on across the country because it asked teachers to look at the relationship between ideas and disciplines and to bring them together as opposed to think of them separately. So Grace's example is one of those hundreds of thousands inspired by Getty's work that shows how a dinosaur, something a kid will never encounter, and it's difficult even for me, who's had the benefit of scientific education, to understand how do we get from knowing something about dinosaurs to knowing something about what I'm going to do tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But knowing how to imagine what the world could have been allows me to imagine what the world might be tomorrow. Naming that she was talking about is also hugely important. To name something is to know something. And it also gives you something, a critical there, to then present to someone else, to you have something to talk about, to share.
There's an ownership of
the
thing.
There's an ownership of a thing and an idea. So taxonomy is in science and taxonomy in life becomes important. So that work is very similar to the work that we're talking about. You talked about the integration work, arts integration. It's also, there's arts integration in art, too. You know, an art teacher, I remember having an art teacher who started out by putting a painting up and asked us, what did we hear?
Hmm.
And we all looked at each other in the class and thought, not sure what that meant. And he didn't let it go until we started actually composing the music of the painting before we were able to talk about what the painting was in terms of its visual aspect and its imagery. And it just opened up worlds. Those people who were more talented in music had something to go to. The art people then contributed. Then where is movement and kinesthetic, in kinetic motion in the painting? All of this comes to be, where is the science in the painting? Where is the history of the painting? It's any one example of an art experience contains in it everything else, so that you can teach whatever you want to teach from wherever you want to begin. The object is, do we have time and resources to keep the kids engaged, and are the kids ready to learn?
And so what we found in the work that we've done over the last decade or so with the cultural community in the district here in Dallas through the research that we've done is that when this kind of learning is alive in the classroom, just like this wonderful woman was explaining to us, what we can measure is the level of engagement that children have in what they're learning goes way, way up. And their investment in the quality of what they're doing as they make what they're making goes way, way up. So we're talking about a kind of intrinsic excitement about learning something that is what happens when real learning is alive in a classroom. And we all know this. When you're really you're doing it not because you just want to get it right, but because you care about what you're learning and you're deeply engaged and it connects to you in some way meaningful. This is the thing that the arts bring to the classroom and to kids in spades.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guests this hour are Gigi Antoni, who is president and CEO of Big Thought, and Daniel Windham, director of arts for the Wallace Foundation. Let's go next on the phones to San in Flower Mound. Hi, San.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was actually wondering how I can encourage my school district. I understand you're working on Dallas currently. I'm in Flower Mound, and how we can encourage our school district to try to incorporate some of the ideas you're speaking of, the 3 to 6 time period. And my son's been in piano for 4 years. He's 9 years old now, and we go to art museums all the time. We're from New York, so we went to Lincoln Center many times with him. Art is very, very important to us, and I was wondering how we can encourage the school to further his education with that.
Thanks for your call.
So one of the ways that we've seen cities be successful, I'm sure Daniel can add to this too, is really taking a look at there's really great research, and you're a parent in this school district, and parents that just say this is important in the right places, to the principal, to the head of the school district, that is the single most powerful thing that can happen to help a school district begin to look at how they can bring this more of this kind of learning. Parents are the lever, and they can make a really big difference. And at Big Thought's website, which is bigthought.org, you can find some links to other places on the web where you can find some great strategies for parents to go and have conversations with school leaders about why this is important and to advocate for that in their local schools.
And if I might also direct you to the Wallace Foundation, wallacefoundation.org, where all of our research is always the reason we do the research and we make the publications is to make them available to people. And so there are some critical works that have been in the last decade put on that website and are available, and we found them to be very well used, and people say that they've had great benefit from using them. So on wallacefoundation.org, there's a Revitalizing Arts Education, which is just loaded with the experience of cities and partnerships across the country. The Gifts of the Muse, now almost a decade old, is a work that started to try and eliminate the rift between the instrumental and intrinsic. Did you want arts education in school because it made kids smarter? Or did you want arts because it was fun to do and it gave them expressive capability? It's not an either-or situation. Mm-hmm. You want both of those.
Right.
And so it tried to get at how those things mutually reinforce each other. cultivating demand for the arts. We started out thinking this was really about state arts councils and the policies of state arts councils, and it turned out to be really a primer for parents and educators mm-hmm. on how to direct themselves through the opportunities and resources that are existing so that the state officials could, in fact, provide the policy to make sure that it was equitably distributed to most people. It wasn't an access. It was an equitable distribution issue. So there's a lot of literature that with the will of the people can actually be applied to make change happen.
Now, I know that you want to reach as many children as is humanly possible, mm-hmm. But can you talk about the advantages of coordinating this at a district-wide level or a city-wide level as opposed to on an ad hoc basis working with sure. the same number of individual schools?
So really the goal here is not as many children as possible. The goal here is every child that grows up in the city. Mm-hmm. So there is part of this is about an equity issue. There are amazing opportunities in the city, but those opportunities aren't actually available to all children. And I'll give you a very small, this is something we found out 13 years ago. When we took a look at, we looked at the aggregate numbers of the children that were being served by the cultural community, and it looked like we were serving hundreds of thousands of children. But when we really looked a level deeper, what we found is it was the same 25,000 kids were going over and over to everything,
yeah.
right? And so this is about making sure that all kids, no matter where they are, have a certain set of experiences as they grow up in our community that develop their voice, their expressive abilities, and help them succeed in school and in life. And that can only happen in a coordinated system. That doesn't happen by what one of our past superintendents used to call random acts of improvement. So they're wonderful programs, but, you know, every child needs a set of experiences, and we have to make sure and take the responsibility of saying we have a role as members of this community that run nonprofit organizations, whether they're cultural agencies or youth development agencies. You know, what is our combined impact on the children that we're trying to serve, and where are we, and where do we need to be more of us, less of us? You know, so that's all a part of why Thriving Minds and is important, and why Big Thought is interested in being a part of that solution.
We're speaking with Gigi Antoni, President and CEO of Big Thought, which runs Thriving Minds, and Daniel Windham, Director of Arts for the Wallace Foundation, which is a major funder for Thriving Minds. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about the value of arts education with Daniel Windham, who is Director of Arts for the Wallace Foundation, and Gigi Antoni, President and CEO of Big Thought. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we find James in Irving. Hello, James.
Yeah, hi. No doubt the arts in school are a valuable resource. But I've heard it mentioned that it seems that participation in the arts tends to be connected with students doing better academically. But how do we know whether it's the participation in the art that's making kids smarter, or if it's just naturally the smarter kids who have an interest in art?
So there's a lot of the recent – it's a great question. A lot of the recent research has been really taking a look at control groups that are demographically matched to groups that are having high arts, and particularly this recent study that really tracks kids over decades to take a look at different points in their development, what the arts have and haven't given. I think we can fairly with fair assurance say that there is an absolute, undeniable, you know, mountain of correlative evidence that the arts are good for all kids, no matter their socioeconomic level, no matter, and that, in fact, you know, it isn't a matter of smart, or it's a matter of what assets kids come with and the arts adding to that and helping them be more successful than they would be without it.
Is there any pushback at all from teachers teaching sort of regular subjects who may have gone through their entire education to be teachers and not have been advised that this would be a really good way to approach their work?
Okay. I'm looking to see if Daniel wants to take that one. you know, the answer to that is that teachers know good teaching. And, mm-hmm. you know, making learning engaging, having the time and the ability and the resources to make these kinds of projects like Betsy described of, you know, where we have an opportunity to explore things beyond facts and information is just intrinsic for teachers. I think they see it, they're given the opportunity to use it, and they go for it. So it's not really a foreign idea. It's more a matter of not having in the past the resources or the support to be able to do that. And the realignment of DISD's curriculum, the cultural community coming to the table, and the resources of both our wonderful funders at the Wallace Foundation, but also local funders and philanthropic community, have now made that possible at scale across the city. And so 6,000 teachers a year do this every day and now in our schools.
How important, Daniel, is it to the Wallace Foundation that there is significant buy-in, and by that I even mean financial buy-in, in the local community, that it's not solely you who are providing the resources for this?
Oh, it's all important, and we don't initiate, so that, as Gigi mentioned earlier, why would we come to Dallas? We come to Dallas because we look across the country to find people who are engaged in solving some of the big problems of communities and in the lives of children. And we happen to notice that in Dallas there was a coming together, and there was a working in ways that we had not noticed in other places. Which means that there was also initial investment at work. People who were from the philanthropic community, from the cultural community, from the corporate community, education, everyone was starting to have this conversation. What we think that our research tells us is there are some noticeable gaps when people do that. One of them is early money, mm-hmm. a new resource of money, catalytic money, if you will. And so what we decided to do in coming to Dallas, and as we do in other sites, is could we come in and eliminate that one burden, that one barrier, and ask people, since that's when we ask them, well, why won't you do more? Well, we don't have the money. Said, if we were to take that away or reduce it, what would you do? So this is this human experiment that philanthropy is engaged in is fascinating. And is also proven to be kind of informative about how human nature works. So Dallas is engaged in the work. Wallace Foundation is looking to propel the work. Our coming to Dallas with we understand that the size of the gift is unusual. Most foundations our size, and a gift is approximately $250,000. So to come in with a $7 or $8 million engagement really means, though, what we're looking for the community to do is to not match it, but go beyond that, bring people together. It's a clarion call, if you will, about if you say this is important, this is your agenda. It's not our agenda. We think it is an appropriate agenda. And the response has been phenomenal. The response from municipal agencies, from the DISD, and from the local philanthropy community, both organized in the corporate and private foundations, as well as just from individuals who are asking themselves, how can I help this community move forward? It's very heartening. It's not a requirement, but it is certainly an indicator of what success and sustainability will be.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll speak next with Lisa in Fort Worth. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I didn't realize maybe you are just talking about Dallas. I'm calling from Fort Worth. And we've had a issue here with the libraries and keeping them open.
For budget reasons?
Yeah, that's what they say. Mm-hmm. And especially in the lower income areas, which because of transportation, you know, issues, I would think they would want to really try to keep those open. And when our education in America is rated so far down the list on a worldwide level, I'm just wondering why libraries wouldn't be a priority. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on what the city or you can do, if this you know, applies to anything you're talking about. I got in a little bit late on your conversation.
Well, I appreciate your call. I'm sure it does apply, and I can certainly hear your frustration there, Lisa. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I think all of our cities, I mean, this is happening here in Dallas, too, and I think that the current economic climate is certainly making us make hard choices, making all of us make hard choices. But I do know that, you know, the lesson from our learning in this work is partnership and advocacy and speaking out about, you know, so getting involved and asking, you know, and saying this is really important to us really can make a difference in the decisions that are made. So if libraries are what needs to be the thing, you know, getting people to go and to talk about that and to ask for that and to make that case is, you know, the best way to get the policy moved.
There's a Wallace Foundation made an investment in libraries across the country, well, it must be 8 years ago, perhaps longer or shorter. But Library Power, this initiative, was in response to that kind of comment about cities making decisions and making choices when economic conditions require them to. So what seems to be discretionary? What can we not do? And we decided to give cities that were grappling with that some money and some resources to redefine what a library is and to not look at it as a drain on the resources that are diminishing, but what is the power of a library? What is it more than a place for books to be housed? It's a place for people to gather. And so these experiments that happened across the country were indications of how people want and can use space that is civic space, that is safe, that is for children as well as adults, that requires, when you think about it as the civic space for people to gather, it's pretty inexpensive, actually, and it also is not necessarily only for reading. So that these libraries that we were able to identify and fund became centers of gathering for the civic good, if you will, and not just places for people to go and check out a book. And their place in the funding hierarchy changed because of how people decided that it was their right to use the library as their space.
And when we talk about when Big Thought talks about this work in Thriving Minds in Neighborhoods and making opportunities available for families, parents, and kids that are meaningful and constructive, libraries and rec centers are extremely important civic spaces to make that happen. And so, you know, those partnerships with our library system and our parks and rec system and our schools, those buildings and those places are places of education and learning, not just places. So if a child and its development is at the center of civic priorities, then these places are going to be at the center of funding because they're important to that.
So stand up and make some noise.
Yeah.
Let's go, not in the library itself.
Not the library.
On behalf of the library. Let's go next to Kelly in Dallas. Hey, Kelly.
Yeah, I wanted to give you a little lesson from the trenches about the unexpected benefits of arts on a child's brain.
Great.
Right before this show started, I was serving my 4-year-old son lunch, and he was playing with those little magnetic toys that consist of a series of bars and balls about the size of a marble and putting them together. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I was reading a paper on sugar metabolism and its role in creating problems like diabetes and coronary disease and Alzheimer's, and the molecular biochemistry of it was extremely difficult, and it was frustrating me. And for the 100th time that my son showed me a different configuration of the Death Star that he was making at the table while he was eating his lunch, and I wished he would just be quiet and let me read, I suddenly flashed on the fact that what he was doing, which seemed to be about narrative, about Star Wars, or maybe about aesthetic choices, was actually reconfiguring his brain in a pretty deep way to understand exactly the kinds of geometric relationships that were frustrating me trying to read this paper. And I have absolutely no doubt that what he was doing, which I saw as an artistic endeavor, was actually preparing his brain 20 years from now to tackle the kind of problems that are frustrating me today. And then he was five steps ahead of me because he was participating in that. And the last thing I wanted to do was stifle the passion that was leading him to do that, because it seemed unimportant to me, and that what I needed to do was let him follow what he was interested in, because his brain was telling him exactly what he needed to do to learn.
What a eureka moment.
Perfect example.
Oh, yeah, it was beautiful. So I think you guys are doing the right work, and thanks very much.
Thanks so much for your call.
Okay.
I wonder if perhaps Kelly could make a model of the things using those little bars and marbles. I think we have time very quickly to take one final call, and we'll speak with Patricia in Dallas. Hi, Patricia. Very quickly, please.
Hi. Yes. Kudos to that dad, and also kudos to you because this show is wonderful, and you keep doing that. When I grew up, I learned things from one grandmother, like embroidering and crocheting and knitting. And it was pushed by German nuns in nursery school. But that's a different part of the world. And when I came down here, nobody does that. And I just wondered if that would also, you would encourage things like textile things you can feel and touch and weave also in your creative classes.
Thank you so much for asking that question. We define the arts at Big Thought and through Thriving Minds very, very broadly. And, you know, the act of creating something and the going through that process is the important thing. And so certainly, you know, things that are handed down from one generation to the other, things like textiles, also poetry, music, community gardens, cooking, all of those things that are everyday acts of creativity, as well as extraordinary acts of learning a new art form and creating a painting or a dance. All of that is incorporated in our definition of creative learning and arts and culture. So we embrace that very, very broadly and think all of that is a very important part of what we're trying to bring to kiddos every day.
We are keenly aware of the power and passion of the amateur.
Absolutely.
And we understand that without the amateur class and without that class being well supported in their quilting bees and in their homes and in their church basements and in their schools, after schools, there is no professional class. So that the professional class actually resides on the shoulders of the amateur class. And so we hope that people will not only for the purposes of passing cultural traditions down and family lore and family strength, but it allows the distinction to reside in a fair and authentic place between those who would then decide to do this exclusively and for money.
Daniel Windham is Director of Arts for the Wallace Foundation, which today announced it will invest an additional large amount of money, millions of dollars, in Big Thought's efforts across Dallas. Gigi Antoni is President and CEO of the creative learning organization Big Thought. You can find more information about them and links to both of their websites on the Think page of KERA.org. Thanks so much to both of you for being here.
Pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.